Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is award-winning journalist and author Peter Golden. Peter and I will be discussing about his debut novel titled Come Back Love. This book is about first love and second chance. Good morning, Peter. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fine. Good morning to you, Johnny, and thank you for having me.
I'm very excited to have you on the show. Come Back Love is beautifully written. It offers great insights about a real relationship built on true love. I think that's very exciting. It's also moving, entertaining at the same time. And I have to tell you, your writing is extremely engaging and captivating with wonderful fluidity. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. I was born in New Jersey, and I grew up there. I went off to college to Ohio University in Athens, Ohio. I finished college at Albany, State University of New York at Albany. I started writing right after I graduated, and I took me about 7 years before I finally made a living at it, and I could work only one job, which was writing. I'm married. I have a son who's in his last year of college. My wife is a professor up here at SUNY Albany, and I write a lot of different things. I've had a very varied career in terms of my writing. So this was a novel that was originally published by a small publisher, Saftex Press, which was the brainchild of Susan Novotny, a owner of independent bookstores, and it was then bought by Atria Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster, and now they have bought my next novel as well.
Fantastic. Congratulations. I knew you had wonderful story to talk about how this novel had a life of its own, so to speak, that sort of took off and got you into the mainstream. So that's a wonderful story. I'm really glad you covered that. When did you discover you have a talent for writing?
I don't know. I'm still working on that. I think that whatever talent you have is latent. Writing is one of those things where you find out what you have by doing it. I think in that way, it's like a lot of art. A lot of people would like to write books and think about the wonderful books they would write, but you really don't know much until you start going. I think if I had to credit anything for my success, I would credit persistence far more than talent.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Do you have any favorite authors that you followed over the years that sort of inspired you?
Yes, I do. I think first and foremost, I think Ernest Hemingway, and not so much for his style, which is when you first start out, it looks so easy, and you think, well, gee, this guy won a Nobel Prize for writing those little sentences. It seems like it should be quite easy to do. Of course, it isn't. Mm-hmm. But what Hemingway brought at the time, and I think successive generations of writers have discovered, was a kind of seriousness of purpose to writing, that writing was a job.
Mm-hmm.
And when you first start out and you have all those these romantic notions about what it means to be a writer and then encounter the reality, which is there are lots of people out there with talent and who are willing to work, and it's very competitive, and most people are not geniuses. And so Hemingway's advice about how to go about starting a career as a writer was very important to me. As for other writers that have had an influence on my work, then I'd have to talk about Flannery O'Connor, James Baldwin and Norman Mailer, and James Jones, sort of the post-war writers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Fitzgerald and The Great Gatsby, which is just an absolute perfect novel. And we'll see if they finally make a good movie out of it. That should be coming out. The problem, of course, with Fitzgerald is that he's so talented that it's kind of hard to learn much from him because he is such a gift with language that it's almost impossible to emulate.
Interesting. Do you have any other writers in the family, like your parents or brothers and sisters, siblings, and so forth?
I had a grandmother that wrote really good letters. But and I have, we're sort of a family of talkers, so I think that might have had some influence on it. But no, I'm the only writer. My sister actually, the first books I started to read seriously when I was in grammar school was the entire series of Nancy Drew. I had the measles, and I was home from school for a while. And my sister had this, older sister had a collection of Nancy Drew, and I read the entire collection. Turns out the woman who wrote Nancy Drew lived in my hometown, which I didn't learn till many years later. But my sister, early on, I guess by the time she was 10 or 11, was writing these mysteries herself. She was, she ultimately became a lawyer. But she clearly had a, I remember reading what she wrote and really enjoying it just as much as the Nancy Drew mystery. So clearly she had some ability for writing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you brought up Nancy Drew, because when I was growing up, I was reading Nancy Drew as well as the Hardy Boys.
Loved the
mystery. And you're right, because it sort of engages you to start thinking creatively. And then you kind of, in your own way, start writing things on your own.
You can learn a lot. I mean, there's a reason when you see something like Nancy Drew that's been around forever. And I'm not talking now, they've reconstituted the series and the woman who wrote, of course, has passed away. But when you write classic children's literature, which is what that is, there's a reason. Just like the Harry Potter books, there's a reason those books are so popular. It's not an accident. And so, yeah, there certainly is. And usually it's a gift for storytelling and creating characters very quickly, which isn't a bad thing to know, even if you go on to write adult.
Interesting. What life experiences influence your writing most?
You know, I've been thinking about that. I think a desire to make time stand still and to travel back and forth in time. I was a big fan of Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court by Mark Twain. And so the idea of time travel always appealed to me. And the idea of freezing a moment in time, I don't know. I remember feeling that way as a child. So I don't think there was some life experience that I had so much as this desire to hold on to the world in a way and to sort of make a picture of the world. I think it's probably analogous to a painter who sees something, or a photographer. A painter, of course, in his or her mind's eye sees something and wants to create it, or a photographer who spots a moment on the street and wants to freeze it. This next novel I'm writing, at the center of it is a photographer, interestingly enough, and she has that feeling about wanting to say things and capture moments. So I think that's probably where it came from, and it's a feeling that I've had ever since I was a little boy. I don't know where it came from.
Very interesting. Do you daydream a lot?
I certainly did more than my parents would have liked while I was in school. I think that what you have with novelists is you have constructive daydreaming. I start my day by driving to Starbucks and then driving home back to my office, which is in my house, and that's sort of the beginning of my day. And on that ride home, I take a back road that goes all the way through this country. And I guess you could call it daydreaming. You let your mind drift.
Yeah.
But it's constructive because I'm often daydreaming in the minds of my characters. So then I often start my day by writing what I thought about while I was taking that ride. So I guess you could say I do daydream a lot, but often it's focused daydreaming, I guess you could call it.
I like the word constructive daydreaming better.
Okay.
It's not a waste of time, you know, when someone asks you, are you kidding me? Are you daydreaming? Yeah, but I am doing constructive daydreaming, so that's pretty good. Your nonfiction work has made it onto bestseller lists and given you opportunities to interview highly notable U.S. figures. What made you want to write a fictional love story instead?
I was writing a history of the Cold War that's actually come out now, and it's called O Powerful Western Star. And I had just finished interviewing Mikhail Gorbachev. And I was home working on the manuscript, And I kept typing the term Soviet Union and USSR so often that I made macros on the keyboard for them because I got tired of typing them over and over again. And I was thinking as I was making the macros, I might as well be writing about the lost city of Atlantis. This place no longer existed.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked myself, what was the greatest change in the United States during the Cold War? And my answer to that question was the role of women and how that impacted the entire culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the midst of writing this Cold War history, I had a few months break, and I started to write this novel. And the way I think of them as, I think of them as twins, although not identical twins.
Mm-hmm.
One is a very wide look at those years, that's the history. And one is a very narrow look at those years, and that's the novel. So that's really the impetus for Comeback Love.
Very interesting. Do you use your writing to express your feelings or just to entertain readers?
Oh, I think my writing comes from the deepest part of who I am, and that's true whether I'm writing fiction or nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I don't subscribe to the fact that a nonfiction writer is telling you this subjective truth. I think of all writing as memoir
mm-hmm,
to some degree,
mm-hmm,
although
mm-hmm.
it's not direct autobiography, which is often where readers get confused, but
mm-hmm.
it's usually some expression of some theme that you probably found very early in your life
mm-hmm.
and you are sort of working on as changes as you get older.
Has your nonfiction work influenced you tremendously in your debut novel?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things people have mentioned about Comeback Love and mm-hmm. been very curious about is how much research did I do
yeah.
in the book? Well, I tell them, first of all, I lived through those years, so that was mm-hmm. the beginning of the research. And then I've spent most of my professional life studying those years. So the idea that it influenced one, you know, in a direct way, I think, it's not quite the word influence, but it put me into that time period. I'm very good
mm-hmm.
at that time period. I'm sort of steeped in it. I'm still
mm-hmm.
learning about it, but I'm sort of steeped in that time period. That's the first part. The other part, I think that narrative is narrative. And whether you're writing nonfiction or fiction, in nonfiction, you're bound by the facts that you create.
Mm-hmm.
In fiction, I'm sorry, by the facts you find when you're writing
mm-hmm.
nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
In fiction, you're bound by the facts that you create. I mean, I think that The Godfather would have been a far less satisfying book if at the end, you know, Michael Corleone had decided to become a social worker. You know, I don't think that really would have made much sense to people. So Puzo, by then, is bound by who we created. And so the book has this sort of ending that feels unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I don't see a large... There are some differences. The main difference is that you can't write anything in dialogue unless you research it when you're writing nonfiction. In fiction, you just make it up. So that's often a little easier.
It's true, though. But at the same time, in reading your book, you have this sort of a wonderful way of really combining. You talk about nonfiction and fiction at the same time. In the nonfiction side, of course, you're talking about the reality of the 60s, the situation, the environment, how it affects individual lives. And then, of course, the fictional side would be the characters that you've created within that real world, so to speak. So you talk a lot about history and you talk about research and so forth. And I thought that in reading your book, I have the opportunity to kind of walk through the history of the United States as it evolves from the 60s to the 70s and so forth.
Well, you'll see some of that because there are these moments that
mm-hmm.
These moments that since have become hardened into signposts for that history. One of them, of course, is the Columbia riots in 1968, Woodstock
mm-hmm.
in 1969, Kent State in mm-hmm. 1970, Nixon's resignation in 1974. These are moments, and they often are coupled with styles and clothing and music
mm-hmm.
that have a lot of meaning for people. But you can't do too much of that because history is filtered through people in very small ways. When you take a wide view and you write a history, then you have to take those events on head on. You have to sort of wrestle with them. Most people didn't have to wrestle with all of them. They were touched by a few of them, but it was a general feeling in the culture that people were moved by. I tend to connect a lot of that with changing roles for women. I tend to think that ultimately when you look back at those years, what was going on was a culture that was slowly becoming adjusted to how women were going to play a much larger role and what that would mean for families and for people in love and ultimately for families and children.
Right. So what is the inspiration behind Come Back Love? It's a wonderful romantic tale that you talked about that runs the span of 35 years.
I think the feeling of middle age is there. I think the idea of the book is told, of course, in the present day and in the past. And I think I always say that regret is a middle age pastime. And so I think that the deepest feeling was getting to a point in my life where I could look back at my life and the lives of friends of mine and have something to say about what it means. The problem with being human, of course, is all the insight comes at the end, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't last as long as all the events that you're ultimately talking about. But it was a worthwhile exercise. And also, for someone who's interested in history, what I did in the book was this couple is sitting in a bar, Gordon and Glenna, and talking about things that happened, and then you see how they played out, and then you go back and hear them commenting on what these things meant to them, which I thought was kind of an interesting way of getting at their personal histories.
Well, the various scenes were very tender and very real, and that's what I like about it. And it's amazing on how well you bring back and forth going through time, present moment, and, of course, rekindling the past and looking back the past, the things that the decisions we make, so to speak. So that's fascinating. How did you come up with the various characters?
Well, I like to say that novels are dreams translated into words, and dreams always belong to the dreamers. I think that all those characters in that book are little pieces of myself, memories of other people that I've known. I mean, if you want to look at some, I guess, if there's some straight autobiography, and it's not really word for word and fact for fact, but the objections that Gordon's father feels towards his choice of career as a writer might have some reality to it. The rest of it is so turned on its head and so filtered through all kinds of artistic filters. Don't forget, I was trying to say something. So you sort of bend behavior to make your point. That I don't think you can the inspiration, I don't know. I mean, part of the joy of writing is when you're done, you see things that you didn't know were there. I mean, that's why else do it. You learn to, it's actually a process of self-discovery.
Well, your writing is just wonderful, as I mentioned earlier, and the way you have written makes me wonder if you have a personal experience with regards to first love itself.
Well, of course I do. I think the big fact about first love, which I sort of take on in the novel, is that what makes first love so powerful is that people in the throes of it don't ever think it's going to end. That's why it's so powerful. The idea of loss hasn't been introduced yet. It never occurs to the person that this is going to have a conclusion. Now, there are, of course, some people who meet a first love and they get married and they deal with loss at a much later date. And I think that was probably more prevalent in my parents' generation. But in the 1960s, where there was more freedom to form those kinds of attachments, I think that so what makes the book universal is that what makes it universal is everybody has that experience, and this experience of loss, and that changes the way people view the world. because it ultimately changes the way people view love in itself. So someone who's been through first love and lost first love knows even later on in their life that when they're perfectly happy in their marriages, that there's a time limit, that things don't last forever. And that's something that's hard for young people to grasp. I mean, I really think that's a middle-aged perception. It's not something that young people think about. So that's why you have to go back and look at it from a middle-aged person's perspective.
Both the younger generation and, of course, the middle-aged individual lives in the present moment. However, I guess for a middle-aged person to truly appreciate this is because we have an opportunity to go back in time and look at the what-ifs.
Right. I think you can't ask those questions unless you get old enough to ask.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you know, back in caveman days and people were living to the age of 30 or 25 or whatever life expectancy was in those days, you didn't have the same sort of issues. Just like we have, just like there are medical concerns we have today that generations ago people didn't worry too much about because they didn't live so long and and things didn't fall apart.
Well, that's interesting, very, very interesting. Your book talked about love in a very profound way. And in reading it, of course, everyone will read it from their own eyes. It's a very personal experience of love. Do you personally feel that love can last forever?
Absolutely. I think that if you love someone, and by that I mean if you get to the point in your life where you someone's emotional concerns are as important to you as your own, and that's what I think is true love, which, by the way, is something I'm not sure that young people are really capable of, then yes, I do. If you're talking about the kind of wild-eyed romantic love that I describe in the when I go back into the younger sections of their lives, I think that changes. It's not this moment-to-moment intensity, but it's different. I mean, I think at least in my life, your mate becomes your whole world. They define the borders of your world. I do. I think it lasts. I think it lasts forever. And I think that people are often devastated when they get to the end of their lives and they have to say goodbye. I think that. That's my view. I do believe love lasts forever.
Are you a romantic person?
I don't know. I think my wife would. I don't know. We would probably get my wife on the phone, and she'd probably say sometimes yes and sometimes no. I don't. I think sometimes, but I think that again, when we talk about love and about the love of that middle-aged people ultimately experience, I think that it has its certainly romantic moments, but mostly what it has is it sets a place for you in the world. It makes you feel like you belong. It makes you feel that it makes you feel whole. So romantic in the way that I describe some of their walks in the snow and things like that. You have that sometimes, but as people go on, they gather all sorts of memories, and sometimes what's most romantic is remembering. And so you get into the issue of memory as opposed to the moment. Young people are much more interested in the moment than memory.
Very true. So who came up with the cover art for your book?
Well, that actually, my agent, Susan Golem, actually had an idea, something that would be reminiscent of the Bob. There's a very famous album cover of those years, Bob Dylan walking down the street with his girlfriend at the time, Suze Rotolo, who actually wrote an interesting memoir and has recently, sadly, passed away. And either walking down the street in Greenwich Village, arm in arm, and it's obviously cold in the paint in the album cover photo. And Susan liked that album cover quite a bit and thought if there was something that could remind people of that. And then the art people at Atria just sort of knocked it out of the park. They just came up with an idea and did it. I think it's a very moving cover. It's very
It is. It is. I like it very much because I think the picture, as one would say, speak a thousand words, and it just captured the moment of what you're trying to express.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought they just did a great job.
Was it difficult for you to write a love story from a male perspective?
That's a wonderful question. Not difficult in that I could do it. It's unusual, mm-hmm. although I think probably that helped sell the book. Now, given what I was interested in, the history mm-hmm. that I was interested in, what I was really curious about to explore was how this, because don't forget, as women's roles changed in the 1960s, mm-hmm. men's roles did change. Men weren't opting to do something different. They were sort of just going about their merry way. And mm-hmm. so what I tried to do in the book was show the impact of the struggle that Glenna has with many of these issues, work and combining work and love, which was a challenge for her, mm-hmm. how that impacted Gordon. I mean, Glenna is a medical student in 1968-69, at a time when only 7% of medical school classes were women. Today, that number, I think, is at least 50%.
Mm-hmm.
So the change has been enormous. And so how did a woman raised in a traditional family with a mother who didn't work outside the home, how did she take on all of these new responsibilities in the very competitive environment of medical school?
Mm-hmm.
And what did that mean for Gordon and their future? And so that's what I was curious at looking at.
And you covered a lot of history in terms of the fight that women had to go through in terms of getting their rights and so forth. And I thought that was fascinating because those are the things that somehow, you know, we're in 2012, we take things
right.
for granted. And that's why I like about your book. It's not just about romance. You talk about wonderful histories that shaped who we are today.
Well, I think, you know, people have always looked at the 1960s as this very, very odd area, a very
mm-hmm.
odd time.
Mm-hmm.
And have looked at socially. But my take on the 1960s, while there certainly were a lot of social changes, a lot of that is rooted in science. And what
mm-hmm.
happened was really quite simple. The birth control pill was invented
mm-hmm.
and antibiotics. And so for the first time in human history, and the only time in human history, there was almost foolproof birth control combined with treatments for venereal diseases that used to be fatal.
Mm-hmm.
So once, and then of course we had the legalization of abortion. So once women had control over that area of their lives, and once young people didn't have to worry that multiple partners would cost them their lives, they would come up with a horrible disease. And this didn't last very long, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
AIDS came along. And people were certainly concerned about that, were bound to behave differently. So there was a lot of freedom that was offered by those turn of events. And so it made a lot of what happened in the 1960s possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was important to look at those, I think, to look at those. You don't hear a lot about that anymore because, as you say,
yeah.
people take effective birth control and treatment for these other diseases for granted. But, of course, mm-hmm. you see, now you can see how strongly people feel about it because when you look about the effort that was made to combat AIDS
mm-hmm.
and you look at how people respond when anyone starts talking about rolling back access to abortion.
Right.
So at some level, people realize this, but I don't think you read about it much when you read social histories of the 1960s. People, as you say, and I think it's a really good point you've made, is people just accept it as a given. But you have to sort of put your mind back into the 1950s when there were lots of young people who were first listening to Elvis Presley and all this new rock and roll and sort of the precursor of what was about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
These young people were terrified of unwanted pregnancies and of venereal disease. And that's well, not so much actually by the 50s, but certainly of unwanted pregnancies. Go back into the 30s and you'll find the same thing. And the 30s had that kind of, and the 20s had that kind of expansiveness. Certainly in not so much as in America. There was some of it in America, in New York, but if you look at Europe, like the Weimar Republic, and there was a kind of enormous explosion of social change that had a lot to do with sexuality and all kinds of things. So, and of course, Nazism was in part a response to some of that, trying to put that back in the bottle.
Very interesting. Your book also touches something very important. It's something that reminded me a few years back of the phrase, life is 10%, 90% is how you respond to it.
I think that's absolutely true. I think that's true. I think you're given a set of circumstances. And when you look at how a culture responds to it, I guess then you have literature and history. That's, I guess, you could say that's at the bottom of what I was trying to do. I was really intent on not having one of the characters be the good person and one be the bad. I had a note on my desk as I wrote this novel, and it said, if you can't be fair to both sides, then you can't write this story. And I think I was pretty fair to both Gordon and Glenna for who bore the responsibility for the things that happened in their relationship.
And it's all based on how we live and the environment that we lived in.
Yeah, I think their story would have been impossible had they been a generation older and not nearly as moving had they been a generation younger. I mean, again, young people take a lot of this for granted. What I find so interesting now about young people is how, despite how highly mobile we are, technically, through technology, they're able to stay in touch wherever they are. They're able to look at each other and talk on Skype. They have emails, and people don't lose track of each other. One of the wonderful things about publishing a novel that's gotten some attention is that all of these people I haven't seen or heard from in, 30 or 35 years have started to contact me or found me on Facebook. I received an email yesterday from someone I hadn't seen since 1973, and he, and it's so funny, it turns out he lives in Woodland Hills, California, and I was just there. I didn't even know he was there on a book tour, and so that's been a wonderful part of this. But this was not possible. People forget, when someone lived in New York and said they were moving to California, with especially young people, with how expensive long distance calling was, and the mail, you know, there's no instant response. You'd write a letter, and then, you know, maybe later you'd get a letter back. I mean, people don't now. People travel all over the world, and they never lose touch.
Well, it's a different sense of appreciation, though, because what happens is that we live in a closed system. You cannot create order without creating disorder somewhere else. So, in today's world, the fact that it's almost instantaneous that we communicate with one another through tweeting and so forth, there is a loss of sensitivity, the sense of appreciation, the longing, the pondering side of the equation, I guess.
I think that's an excellent observation. I think it's actually in so many different ways. One of the things I remember, I have a friend who's from Nebraska, and he was born in the mid-1940s. And he was a rabid New York Yankees fan. And he didn't move to New York until the 1970s. And he told me, and I thought this was really remarkable, he had never seen a Yankees game. So that these people in those days, it would have been Mantle and Maris and all
all the greats,
were like, were mythological to him. And when you go back and look in the 1920s at Babe Ruth, he might as well have been Paul Bunyan. He was people never saw him. They read about him in newspapers at a time when sports writers wrote remarkably exciting prose about the game. So there's a kind of familiarity today with all of our heroes, with the villains, with each other, that is really relatively new as far as human beings are concerned. It wasn't Americans. What I think what connects when you look at the baby boomers, what I find connects them is was the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Most baby boomers, if you sit down in a room with people who are baby boomers and you put on a Beatles album, you can be pretty sure that everybody in that room knows the words to every one of the songs,
mm-hmm.
and could sing it, and has probably known those words since 1964.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a kind and television shows, which mm-hmm. seemed to have Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, lines from certain movies. This was the first generation. I mean, it was predicted that one day we would have sort of a global village. Well, the first step there
mm-hmm.
was were television shows, were popular culture that was passed along by TV and radio. Don't forget, I mean, again, this is something else you take for granted. I mean, now we have the internet, so we're on the radio over the internet. But think about what it was like when radios were almost as big as TV sets,
mm-hmm.
and that then they went down to smaller radios, but you couldn't carry them around. And then they come with these inexpensive transistor radios made in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and all of a sudden, kids walking to school can listen to the World Series on the radio,
mm-hmm.
can listen to music on the radio. They were sort of that generation's iPod. Of course, mm-hmm. you couldn't listen to it at school, but the whole idea, and this is how people were initially, that generation was initially connected.
Mm-hmm. Very true. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Come Back Love?
Well, I think readers come to it depending on where they are in their lives,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of different, there are a lot of things to get from the book. I think for people, for baby boomers, it's a chance to, and I've received a lot of email about this,
mm-hmm.
a chance to sort of think about their lives. For young people, and I've had a lot of young people write me as well,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For young people, it's a chance to think about their own experiences with first love or looking around for their first love and starting to understand, to some degree, how the forces that help shape their parents and grandparents,
mm-hmm.
which is something, you know, kids always imagine that their parents' lives are far more sedate,
mm-hmm.
and sort of just mm-hmm. travel along this straight line,
mm-hmm.
Than their lives. And I think this is a look at what life was like for people at a certain time, and help people understand that, you know, there's more that unites us than divides us as humans.
Very true. And also, love is just love. There's no right or wrong. Love is love.
I think the other part of love that I've talked about with people is this kind of odd thing that happens when you reconnect mm-hmm. with people in your past. And this has happened with just friends of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Right before the book came out, a guy that I'd gone to camp with when we were little boys found me on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't seen him in I'd say 45 years. And he was going to be in New York City at the same time that I was. And mm-hmm. he said, "Why don't we get together?" So we met for a drink in the Roosevelt Hotel, and we spent about 3 minutes catching up,
mm-hmm.
about, you know, whereas he's been married this long, his children are doing this, I've been married that long, my son is doing that. And after that, it was like we had never not
been apart.
Been
yeah.
And we had, and now our, you have to understand, for 5 summers in a row, our beds were next to each other. We were very good friends.
Mm.
And what I thought after that meeting was the following. If you sat on your computer 10 years ago and you wrote something and you saved it on a CD, let's say,
mm-hmm.
then put it in your computer and recalled it, that document intact, most likely, would be right there on your screen. And I think to some degree people's minds function that way. That you have this image of a person, you have all this collected memory of a person, and it's stored. And you might not use it for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when you recall it, as someone contacts you and you recall it, all of the positive or negative, depending on what the relationship was like, sort of come back with those stored feelings. And I think that, this is true in a purely platonic kind of male friendship. And I think that holds true in romantic relationships as well. So, I mean, when Gordon first walks in and sees Glenna, he still thinks she's beautiful. They still, they easily fall back into the same sort of relationship and repartee that they used to have when they were young. And I think that's how the human mind works. So I don't think it seems miraculous, but I'm not so sure that it is. And I think the computer metaphor is helpful in understanding that.
What are some of the response that you have gotten from the baby boomers? Because I know this is a very personal experience of love. In reading your book, each one will sort of get the message that you were trying to give them from a unique perspective of is very individualized.
Well, I think I've heard a lot. I mean, and it's still here. I'm doing book clubs, and it, for people of that age, it's it has an even, I think, a deeper meaning, because it often sends them back to their own time. I think that's the beginning of the 1960s when baby boomers started off their college. If you say the baby boom starts in 1946, so the first baby boomers go off to college, let's say in 64, 65. The similarity of their experience, I think, was so profound and so unique that it was very hard not to feel kinship with it. Now, in another example, my uncle served in the Second World War. He was at Normandy, and that ended, of course, for him in late 1944 after he was wounded. And the men in his unit, he stayed in contact with them and met periodically with them for the rest of his life. And you say, well, why did they do that? And I think they did it because they had such a unique and yet common experience. These men were from all sorts of walks of life, had come along and grown up in such far different ways. I think when you start to talk about baby boomers, that you start to find that they had very similar experiences. So the book has a lot of... No one has said, well, gee, that wasn't anything like my life. Of course it was. Just what was so different about the culture. Now, some people liked it, some people didn't. But I think in the end, it's had, it's done well with people that age.
You're right talking about the different stages of love, and you mentioned about platonic love for human being, a person to a person. As I read your book, Come Back Love, besides the romantic side, boy meets girl, boy fall in love with girl, that kind of thing, as I mentioned to you, you talked a lot about the history that was happening during the time that these people were involved over a span of 30 years or so. The uniqueness of what I'm getting out of it as well, as you had mentioned, we're talking about human beings, common bond. And when you had the opportunity to look back in time and you start looking back at all the what-ifs in life, you have a different sense of appreciation of the deeper, profound meaning of love, whether it's motherly love that I wrote about, but you're writing about love between human beings. And that's what I like about it.
Oh, I appreciate that. I mean, someone once said that it's all projection after the first, you know. In other words, it's your attachment to your mother, and then the rest of your life you spend sort of having an attachment like that with other people. I think that, you know, when I was a young boy, I remember seeing older people, much older people. And when they would speak to each other, they would refer to each other as mother and dad. And I thought that was very odd. I don't think it's so odd anymore, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, you spend... many people spend a large part of their married life being called mom and dad by, of course, their children. So for a long period of time, you have these new nouns to describe each other. But I think that, and so there's some habit in that. But I also think that as we get older and we stay attached to the same person, we sort of go backwards. We go backwards. We become I mean, at the center of us, I think, there is always this infant mm-hmm. who needs to be loved.
Right.
Sometimes that infant gets us in trouble because he or she is more demanding mm-hmm. than might be good, or quicker to take offense
mm-hmm.
than might be warranted. But in the long run, I think that the people are needy. Now, there is a fair amount of, and some of this, and this is the issue that Glenna struggles with, there's mm-hmm. a fair amount of denial in the 1960s about how actually needy people were. Mm-hmm. For example, the denial of sexual jealousy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that plays a part in love. And then, of course, there is a book written during this time period called Open Marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, though, the authors, the O'Neills, recanted and felt that it didn't work out as well as they had anticipated. But, I mean, I think there was a lot of that in the 1960s as well, denial
mm-hmm.
Of that. It was sort of a back-to-innocence movement, and so that we were sort of in the garden again and mm-hmm. everything was okay. I think that, of course, proved not to be true. But in the long run, I would agree with you. I think that attachments at this level remain. I mean, I think they survive death, certainly of one or the other. I just think that, you know, and even when people, older people, might lose a mate and remarry, I don't think mm-hmm. they give up the attachment to their first spouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, you can buy it anywhere, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, which I love, and I think people ought to frequent since they're good to have around, and if you don't buy books there, they won't be here. So any independent bookstore, and of course all the chains have it as well, Barnes & Noble and all the others. It also actually is in, it's also around in supermarkets, and I think mm-hmm. Walmart has it, and I mean, it's around. It's all over the place.
That's wonderful. How has your writings impacted you personally over the years?
Well, it bought my house, paid the mortgage. I guess it helped send my son to college. How is it? For me, to get up in the morning and be able to write a sentence that pleases me
mm-hmm.
is the greatest pleasure in the world, and that I've been able to do it for a career for, oh gosh, now I'm close to 30 years, seems to be the luckiest, most remarkable thing that I could describe, beyond having a wife and a son.
Mm-hmm.
They say that would be the impact.
That's interesting, very, very interesting. The book that you have coming out right now that's not fiction, which is All Powerful Western Start, you had the opportunity to talk to Richard Nixon.
Right.
How was he like?
Well, by the time I got there, I mean, I'll tell you a funny story. I walked in and I had heard that for obvious reasons he didn't like to be taped, but I thought I would take a flyer, and I in those days, you know, a portable cassette recorder was
yeah.
now people think of it as looked like the size of a Buick. But
right.
I walked in, and before I could ask him if I could tape, mm-hmm. I dropped it and it landed on his foot. So that was my less than auspicious beginning. But he was very nice, and I taped it. And then after the interview, he started to write a little bit. We started to write back and forth. So mm-hmm. It was, I would say, I saw the lion at dusk. You know, I
mm-hmm.
don't.
Mm-hmm.
What I saw was a deeply thoughtful person who was doing his best to explain to me
mm-hmm.
why he made the kind of choices he made
mm-hmm.
with respect to foreign policy. Mm-hmm. Very, very nice to me. And very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So, this raging, I guess you hear him on the tapes, furious and raging at people. That wasn't the man that I met.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Sure. I mean, I don't know that it'll work for them, but there is a political commentator by the name of Walter Lippmann, who once said that something to the effect that to be happy, you need someone to love, right? Something to
mm-hmm.
do,
Mm-hmm.
It's something to look forward to. So for me, the trick is to meet all of those criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess to bring in the 1960s, Bob Dylan comment that if you get up in the morning and do what you like to do until you go to bed, you have to count yourself lucky. And I think lessons in middle age are really that life is not easy, but simple. And for me, the simpler my life is, the better. So I boil it down to my work and my family and what I and still holding on to some goals. I would also say this, because we all know that the end awaits us all, that in order not to be too taken up with that idea, I think it's helpful to do something for other people. I think it's helpful to volunteer. I think there's a kind of, whether it be getting involved in the local politics, whether it be getting involved at a shelter, whether it be tutoring children, whatever you can, whether it be helping out some of your elderly neighbors, there's something about doing something for other people as you get older that adds a level of meaning to your life, that allows you to see the circle is not so frightening. At least that's been my experience. So I guess that would be my recipe. It's not much of a recipe because it's still very hard. You have to find someone to love and make that work. And you have to find something to do that gives your life meaning. And you have to have a goal. And I think material things are usually, those are good, helpful when you're younger. I mean, I want to buy a house. I want to buy a car. I want to have enough money to go on vacation. But I think once you get to those places in your life, you have to sort of simplify things a little bit and then hold on to your dreams as long as you can. So I guess that would be my recipe. What's your recipe? Do you have a recipe?
I do, but I think to take off on what you just said is that in order for you to find someone to love, you have to be open to be loved as well.
Oh, that's why I said you have to do the things that, like I said, simple, not easy. It's simple to say find someone to love. It's not easy. One of the things with that that's very helpful, it's always helped me, is to remember that what a great bargain you are. So when you're being, when you're feeling a little critical, you have to remember there's another side to the story. And again, to go back to the novel Comeback Love, that was the challenge of that, was to show both of them as being sometimes highly annoying. And you have to, I think, it's helpful in my marriage to remember that I'm not perfect.
Well, you covered everything in terms of how love should be lived and experienced, because you have to be able to be open to love in order to receive love. And it's just not so much about giving. It is also about receiving.
Yes, I think that sometimes people think that should be easier than it is. But again, Glenna struggles with that issue quite a bit in this novel, Comeback Love. Gordon so clearly loves her, but that makes her life in some ways harder. And so I think you're absolutely correct. I think that that presents a challenge. That's part of growing up. That presents a challenge to people. Absolutely.
Do you have any advice for couples who are in love for the first time?
I do. I do. I don't know if it's good advice, but I think be careful. It's fragile. I mean, one of the things, you know, as you get older and you hear the story, people whose marriages don't work out, one of the things you find as you listen to the stories is it's not because they both didn't want it to work out, that marriages break. And that no matter how well-meaning both sides are, they can't be put back together. So regardless of how angry you get, be careful what you say and be careful what you do. And probably count to 175 before you do or say anything when you're angry. I think probably one of the, I guess the best piece of advice I ever got is don't be so impulsive. Tomorrow's coming.
Live in today, but always plan for tomorrow as well.
There you go.
Any final thoughts about Comeback Love?
No, I just thank you so much. This has been such an interesting interview. I hope people enjoyed it. I certainly have. It's just been a lot of fun. And thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.
It's wonderful, Peter. Thank you for the great recipe for living that you have shared with us and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. And to all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be author Susan Heim. Susan and I will be discussing about her latest book in the best-selling Chicken Soup for the Soul series titled Here Comes the Bride, 101 Stories of Love, Laughter, and Family. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Peter, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.